Air Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 114, LDS Women, A Reflection on Rights and Power, inspired by John Shelby Spang's Born of a Woman, a paper presented by Frances Nelson Henderson, with a response by Paul Tinker.
Good morning, and welcome to Session number 114, LDS Women, A Reflection on Rights and Power, inspired by John Shelby Spang, Born of a Woman. Our presenter this morning is Nelson Henderson. He was born in the church in Raleigh, North Carolina. He served a mission to Southern California from 1962 to 1964 and graduated with a BA in Physics from BYU in 1968. He was married in Temple. He is a founding member of Comtel, a satellite communications company, where his focus was firmware development. He's now employed by Northrop Grumman Space Technology Division. We married Nelson and family live near San Diego, California. Nelson, I love that you have a daughter who lives there. And I will turn the time over to Nelson for his paper.
My purpose this morning is to encourage LDS women to go the hard route, to break with tradition, to make a revolutionary change to her rights and her power in the church. First, I will use Episcopal Bishop John Shelby Spang's writings in Born of a Woman and rescuing the Bible from fundamentalism to attempt to undermine biblical myths that define women as second-class citizens. And I will suggest that the image of Mary of Nazareth is a male-created figure that embodies the kind of woman that dominant males think is ideal, docile, obedient, and powerless. Second, I will ask, what might challenging patriarchal religious beliefs mean to LDS women? I will broaden the challenge by calling into question the creation story, its male prejudice towards Eve, from the perspective view given by Charles Darwin. Third, I will discuss women's complicity in her own subordination. Fourth, I will identify the mechanisms of control by which church women are subdued and her self-worth undermined. And finally, I will identify self-worth and self-trust to be at the root of women's power. I assert that the power of church leadership is derived from the consent of the people, half of whom are women. Hence, given the small degree of unity among a vigorous and vocal minority, church women could claim their place of power and claim their rightful influence in the reformation of the church. First is to challenge the Bible-based view of women. I had always wondered if the Bible's great age is cause to believe that its message is wise. Bishop Spang uses biblical scripture to point out areas that most harshly conflict with enlightened modern understanding of not only women's rights, but human rights as well. For example, in the Hebrew scriptures, captive women were used for sexual sport. Judah treated his daughter Tamar as a prostitute and then proposed to kill her when she became pregnant. The Old Testament God appears in some passages to be not only a nationalistic deity, but also a sadistic one who delighted even in the killing of the firstborn of the Egyptian children in every household. Menstruation was unclean, and whatever the menstruating woman touched was unclean. If a spirit of jealousy came upon a man, he could order his wife to undergo the ordeal of drinking a poisoned potion. If the woman died, her guilt was confirmed. If she survived, she was presumed to be innocent. One shudders to think of the mentally unbalanced males who put their wives to death needlessly under this male-inspired law that was said to be the word of God. Are these views we would adhere to, or that we would want to hold as our own? Yet they are part of the Bible that many Christians even today say is the literal word of God. The ancient Hebrew patriarchal world carried on into Jesus' day. Men ruled, women were ruled. It was considered inappropriate for a man to speak to a woman in Jesus' day. The Bible even defines women as the property of a man. Such Bible-based oppression of women has continued for 2,000 years. The Christian church has participated and supported the oppression of women primarily through the church's ability in the name of God to define a woman and to make that definition stick. We don't like to be reminded that that definition has stuck. Women in this country could not own their own property and their own name in most states until the latter part of the 19th century. Women did not have universal suffrage in this country until 1920. Women cannot be ordained in the major churches of the Christian faith because those churches still treat women as if they are second-class citizens. Christians who live by a higher ethical code than that described in their own scriptures have already made a decision not to apply all of the teachings of those scriptures. Now I ask, why do we in the 21st century LDS Church still apply those outdated and shameful traditions when it comes to the rights and power of women? Women's self-definition is influenced by important models like that of Mary. However, just as Mormon writers are creative in the telling of our own faith-promoting histories, early Christians may also have written about Mary to suit their prospective convert audiences. That is Spahn's point in the example of the virgin birth story. It is significant, Spahn says, that only Matthew and Luke, who wrote 90 to 100 years A.D. and who were addressing the expanding Gentile presence in the church, only they tell the story of the virgin birth. Spahn cites 9 examples of the virgin birth associated with the divine origins of heroes of Greek and Roman mythology that were transferred to the biographies of historical figures like the Pharaohs, Alexander the Great, and Caesar Augustus. As he looks at the discrepancies between Christ's birth and Matthew and Luke, Spahn summarizes, the minimum conclusion is that both versions cannot be historic. The maximum conclusion is that neither version is historic. The latter conclusion is the overwhelming conclusion of historical scholars today. Indeed, it is the almost uncontested conclusion. Not only is the biblical story of Mary and the virgin birth to be challenged, but Catholic theologian and priest Father Tissot Alasharia, in his book, Mary and Human Liberation, challenges the negative female image of Eve as told in the creation story. His challenge is from the perspective of male prejudice rather than from evolution. The interpretation of the Genesis story given by the fathers of the church, especially after Augustine, was that woman was the cause of the fall. She was the temptress, the accomplice of Satan, the destroyer of the human race. The identification of Eve with evil became so common in Christian thought that the serpent acquired female features in Michelangelo's painting of the fall in the Sistine Chapel. Male theologians and clergy have been responsible for the perpetuating this denigration of women throughout the centuries. This simplistic and damaging interpretation of the Genesis text calls into question the Genesis text itself and of male superiority and prejudice. The creation of this stereotype took a long time, and Spahn attributes its final achievement to the 5th century theologian and philosopher Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, who stigmatized Eve as the source of corruption. Spahn looks at Augustine's biography to explain his attitude. Before his conversion, he describes himself as a libertine, prayed over constantly by his pious mother. He fathered a son on his long-term mistress, but then became a convert to Christianity, renounced his faith, abandoned his mistress and his child, and took up the higher calling of a Christian ascetic. Ultimately becoming a priest and bishop, he expressed little concern for his mistress and his child from that point on. They were expendable for the righteous Augustine, summarizes Bishop Sprung. His primary spiritual task was to remove the stain of his sexual desire. He thus became the great theologian of guilt and sin, but as is so often the case, he remains blind to the price that others must pay for his own self-righteousness. And from that day to this, the church has trafficked in guilt and enhanced its power by rising ever higher the levels of sexual guilt in both women and men. Sex clearly said the church was not designed for joy or for love or for recreation. Sex was evil, save as a means of keeping alive the human race. The sexuality of the woman was most evil of all, for she was the source of male desire. How's that for a transfer? Although Mormonism contains the healthy doctrine of the fortunate fall and asserts somewhat obtrusely that Eve's transgression was not the same as a sin, I would argue that Mormonism yields to no religion in its ability to couple sexuality with guilt. This asexual Mary was imposed on believers through an all-male hierarchy that insisted these definitions of women were divine, unchanging, and imposed by God. Any attempt to challenge these assumptions or to suggest some other possibilities were immediately condemned as a sin against God, the Bible, or the divine nature of creation. Any attempt to open the ecclesiastical hierarchy to women was met by screams that God's will, expressed through an all-broken, all-male sacred tradition, was being violated. The emotional response betrayed the irrationality of the fears as well as the weakness of the argument. Those sexist attitudes can be challenged only by challenging the doctrine of God, the meaning of Christ, the definition of sin, the role of the Savior, and the structure of the church on which they are based. Many Christian denominations are enmeshed in the challenge to patriarchal views of women. Mormonism has yet to even engage the issue in any serious way. And documents like the Family, a proclamation to the world, which are now being called inspired by general authorities, are a measure of the ecclesiastical resistance to serious discussion on the equality of women. Yet Bishop Sprung predicts with considerable optimism, if that resistance succeeds, the church will die. The church will have won the battle only to discover that it has lost the war. Only the church that manages to free itself from the sexist definitions of women will survive. But the feminine side of God in some new incarnation will arise to take her place. And when that occurs, the Church of Jesus Christ will be more whole, more inclusive, more reflective of the reality for which the Word of God is assembled. Second, what does rejecting patriarchy mean to LDS women? Can she claim with integrity to be a Christian and at the same time dismiss the masculinity of the Christian deity? Can she remain inside the church when the maleness of God is a concept that has been used for thousands of years to justify the oppression of women by religious institutions, universally relegating women to clearly defined secondary roles until the latter part of the 20th century? Does she care to worship in a church dedicated to a God called Father that has consistently justified its rampant discrimination against women as the will of this patriarchal deity? Can she contribute where the leadership are all men, sitting in solemn assembly and committed to the sexist prejudice, intending to stay that way, and acting as if they can determine what a woman can do with her own body? For example, in just 16 years, a close relative of mine gave birth to 9 children. Tragically, 3 of the last 5 children were discovered to be severely mentally retarded. Birth control could be appropriate. However, she could not feel it right to choose to use birth control without the consultation and blessing of her local church leaders. Even for married couples, sex, she was taught, is not designed for love and for joy. Open quote. The prime purpose of sex desire is to beget children. Sex gratification must be had at that hazard. Close quote. Thus taught President Spencer Bradley Kendall, Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith, BYU President Ernest L. Wilkinson, George Q. Cannon, and others. We live in a world where the expansion of knowledge has obliterated the reality that was perceived by the ancient Hebrews. And at the time Christianity was formulated, that vengeful, patriarchal God of antiquity has become not just unbelievable, but is in fact no longer worthy of devotion. The revolution in religious belief is broader than just sexism alone. We no longer believe that epilepsy and mental illness result from demon possession, even though Jesus was portrayed in the Bible as believing that they did. We no longer believe sickness results from being punished by God, nor healing a sign our chastisement is complete. Instead, our belief is in Western medicine. We believe in the use of antibiotics to attack bacterial diseases and antiviral cocktails to block the receptor sites marked by the surface proteins of the HIV virus. Because we live in a time of Charles Darwin, we know these living microorganisms selectively evolve inside our bodies to become resistant to these medications. In 1859, Darwin's masterpiece entitled The Origin of the Species was published. And that book caused to go up in smoke the religious idea that by her transgression, Eve, the mother of humankind, had caused all to be cast into a fallen state of imperfection. Instead, Darwin suggested that the world of creation was not yet finished. The world, he said, was still evolving, still being created. We are not fallen from a state of perfection to be rescued by God's Son and restored to a perfection that we never had. But we are highly evolved animals with superior brains and related to all life on earth. The Christian church resisted Darwin with vigor, but the ecclesiastical power of antiquity had already been broken, and the church's ability to threaten Darwin with execution as a heretic no longer existed. And today, whether we like it or not, Charles Darwin's thought organizes the biological sciences of the Western world. His work has made possible once unthinkable things as organ transplants using the organs of subhuman species. They worked because Darwin was right. My cousin Jimmy had the heart valve of a pig replace his defective valve. The pig valve, he told me, was chosen because along with its size, the pig is genetically close to humans and thus less likely to be rejected. That strange thing called creation science is nothing more than the ignorant ranting reflecting a frightened and dying religious mentality. And so also is that foundational religious myth of Eve's transgression that has been used throughout millennia to teach and to justify the denigration of women. Not only sexism, but faced with revolutionary change on many fronts like that of evolution, the institutional church seems fearful of inquiry, fearful of freedom, fearful of knowledge, indeed fearful of anything except its repetitious propaganda, which has its origin in an ancient world which none of us any longer inhabits. Again, the question, would I be wiser and more honest if I were to do what so many others in my generation have done, namely, resign from my membership in the faith system? Should I renounce my own baptism, deny that I am any longer a disciple of Jesus, take up membership in the secular city, become a member of the Church of Mumbai Association? However, by walking away, we grant power to those who have claimed control of the community from us. Do I want to concede that? Most Latter-day Saints do not acknowledge a power struggle exists, nor any conflict of interest, nor see the present centralization of authoritarian power into the hands of a relatively few men does not mean that their victory is permanent. The dignity, rights, and power of women make that victory unstable. Third, how are women complicit in their own subordination? Church women and men are in deep collusion with the victory of authoritarianism. As Eric Fromm explains in his book, Escape from Freedom, I was stunned the first time I read Fromm's description of submission and the authoritarian character. As if to say, how kind of you to want to live my life for me. The Mormon authoritarian character would probably disagree that there is an escape from freedom and responsibility because she or he may consciously conceive of herself as free and subject only to herself. However, that this escape has indeed occurred is illustrated first by the total absence of financial accountability for tithing required by the contributing membership of their church leadership, but that no lay tithe payers require or are provided this information is shocking. Secondly, the faithful Mormon authoritarian character will say that her or his individual freedom and autonomy are fundamental religious precepts. Yet she is silent about this or supportive of the forceful repression of the freedom of speech. As when church women are excommunicated for the expression of opposing views, even among Mormon intelligentsia, this culture of public silence is justified as the Mormon way. However, by this loyalty to authority, the development of her character is stunted. Normally, love is based on freedom and equality of power, but in the authoritarian system, the meaning of love and self-love are confounded with submission, an attitude of self-denial for the sake of communal unity, and the surrender of one's own rights and power are perceived as examples of great love, duty, and devotion. However, just the opposite is true, in that loyalty and obedience are placed ahead of self-trust, because love, self-interest, not self-denial, are the essential affirmations of one's own life, happiness, growth, freedom, and purpose. Likewise, the teaching of sacrifice is a perversion of true sacrifice if the individual self is in submission to the higher power of an authoritarian system. Rather, sacrifice has moral authority only when the individual acts freely in the sense of spontaneity, acknowledging no higher authority or motive than from within themselves. Indeed, one of the most obvious losses of individual self in Mormonism is the submission of endowed temple goers to the church laws of obedience and sacrifice. Many conscientious women, in that self-sacrificial way that they are taught, have already given so much of themselves that they no longer have energy to give more. But implicit in that sweeping temple covenant of seeking to be all-giving and perfect is the expectation that those calling you to service will understand your circumstances. You implicitly expect that the church will know your needs and respect your needs. You expect that other persons in your life and the church to know the limitations of how much you can give. You are entrusting the boundaries and the shape and the direction and the inspiration of your life to others. Thus, you have issued a sweeping invitation to someone else to make free with your life. You expect to be protected from your own openness and your own generosity, but you are not really being generous and kind. When you give up what you want, when you expect an organization to be in charge of what you can give, you are placing an impossible demand. You have participated in the setting of a trap. Obediently, women sacrifice the most valuable things they possess to the church's prescription for their lives. They give their time to church attendance and service, their money to tithing. They sacrifice their unique personal choices about career and lifestyle to a one-size-fits-all conformity. They obediently forgo their own self-discovery and self-empowerment. In submission to external church expectations of achieving a personal perfection. However, such ideas about the virtue of selflessness are mistaken. And believing that such an idea as the perfect human being is only another way of mistreating oneself. Ironically, one of the transcendent experiences of joy and of ecstasy is the experience of escape from expectations. The deep realization that she is okay just as she is, and reawakening to her own worth and beauty. Fourth, what are the mechanisms of control by which church women are subdued and by which her self-worth is undermined? To produce revolutionary change requires an understanding and a correction of the mechanisms by which the church so effectively domesticates women to accept her own oppression and even inducing her to promote it. Gloria Steinem hints at women's vulnerability and men's in the title, Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem. She believes that self-esteem plays as much a part in the destiny of nations as it does in the lives of individuals. A self-hatred leads either to the need to dominate or to be dominated. That citizens who refuse to obey anything but their own consciences can transform their countries, and in short, that self-esteem is the basis of any real democracy. However, the truth is that by women's constant silent accommodation, she internalizes society's low estimate of all that is female. The result is a lowered self-esteem. Steinem further points out there is little mention of organizational structures that undermine her worth in order to assure their own authority. First among Mormon examples is the undermining of self-worth when the innate goodness of our human nature is called into question and said to be dependent on obedience to church law and priesthood authority. Otherwise, she is declared to be in a fallen state, naturally carnal, sensual, and devilish. It is a denigration of her very being. Alma Ford. Second is the undermining of individual conscience by suppressing freedom of speech. Because to the extent that she self-censors herself, and to the extent that she adopts the code of public silence, and to the extent that she sacrifices her moral agency to church demands to follow the brethren, then to that extent is her integrity and personhood devalued, and the church's espoused purpose defeated. That purpose is her self-development and her empowerment. Lesser priorities are church influence, power, control, reputation, church programs, and church image. On the dome of the Jefferson Memorial are inscribed the words, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility to every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Yes, the church does use excommunication or the threat of it to intimidate and control women. However, difference of ideas cannot be the basis of separation among God's children. Third is the undermining of individual privacy, as in worthiness interviews in which one's personal qualifications are judged. For example, does she pay a full 10% tithing? Does she attend her church meetings and fulfill her church duties? Is her religious faith appropriate? Is she morally, sexually clean? However, Dr. Harriet Lerner says differently, that a woman's right of privacy includes her right to control access to the emotional as well as the physical space that she takes to be hers alone. She does not want her mail opened, her journal read, her phone tapped, her property searched, her behavior monitored, her medical records or her sexual history revealed. She closes the door to her home, her office, the bathroom, and the voting booth. She requires periods of time each day in which she is not spoken to, looked at, or focused on. Her right of privacy is a critical aspect of her self-preservation. It protects her from intrusion and ensures her separateness as a human being among others. Her right of privacy includes her right to protect her body and her any decisions regarding it from unwanted control and intrusion by others. She is entitled to make personal choices about reproducing, loving, and dying without state intervention. If she does not control her own body, she does not control her own life, and she is in no position to seek or to define her own truths. Fourth, church truth claims stated with the certainty of knowing beyond any doubt are willful, coercive acts that undermine women's integrity and sense of worth. Instead, faith is a plunge into the unknown. It is the opposite of testimony, and that uncertainty, not knowing for sure, is the virtue to be admired. Fifth, and last, is the emphasis on obedience, because it undermines moral living. Instead of obedience, discipline, and control, moral living is an authenticity rooted in freedom, love, spontaneity, and genuine delight, without any ulterior motive like getting to heaven. To obey is not enough. Slaves obey. Purity of motive is essential, because and motive is corrupted by fear, hope of a reward, or a burdensome sense of duty. Individual freedom always takes precedence over the duty. At the center of a woman's life is the quest to discover, speak, and live her own truths. To cease living a life dictated and defined by others. For her, there can be no greater stress than that generated by denying the authentic self. It takes so much energy to be who you are not. It takes so little to be who you truly are. Even your life expectancy is shortened by the stress of trying to be who you are not. Instead of obedience, love is the only passion that satisfies our need to unite, while at the same time acquiring a sense of integrity and individuality. The list of self-diminishing organizational controls could go on. The controls don't even need to be taught, because they are the natural and obvious workings of the opposite paradigm of love that seeks instead unity through obedience and submission. Finally, will LDS women have the self-esteem and self-trust that is required to assert themselves and to claim their power? Are we naturally worthy of trusting ourselves? If she doubts so, then she has internalized the self-doubt that leads to her subordination. Your male leaders spot this internal in uncertainty and meekness in an instant. In fact, they may even demand it. However, the pervasive, unspoken premise in the work of spiritual and emotional healing is that we are innately good, as in God is good. In his book, On Becoming a Person, Carl Rogers argues trustworthiness is the basic nature of human beings. Yes, and I argue that trusting ourselves is ultimately inescapable, try as we may. Even when we try not to decide for ourselves by being a follower of others or of a church, we have still made a choice of who or what to follow. So we are inescapably, personally responsible for everything we choose for ourselves on our own, and responsible for everything chosen for us by the church or its leaders that we choose to follow, because we have chosen in all cases. The extension of this argument to the extreme is that we are individually responsible for the actions and teachings of our own church. Dr. Harriet Lerner emphasizes the need for more self-honesty in women. It is painful and exhausting for a woman to begin to uncover her own truths in a culture that validates only male experience, but that the politics worth having, the relationships worth having, demand that we go this hard route. For women to go the hard route is to fly in the face of all that has been prescribed for us regarding our possibility and place, to say nothing of good manners. It also requires us to protest the exclusion of women from public life when we collude with the objectification, diminishment, and invisibility of women. We compromise all manner of clarity, truth, and honor. There are, however, many categories of pretending in which men will not participate. Men will not pretend, for example, that words like she or chairwoman should ever truly include them. Men will not pretend that words like womankind represents humankind. Men will not fail to notice when they are excluded from a particular subject, event, discourse, or governing body. All leaders obtain their power through the consent of the people, even if that consent is obtained by the coercive claim of being right or being the only true church. Control is always the purpose behind these truth claims. We know so because church leaders do not publicly acknowledge their mistakes. They blaspheme God instead, as if God could be the reason why their racism caused them to deny the priesthood to African American church members. They attribute to God their blatantly racist teachings that they have still failed to correct and to publicly renounce about the Lamanites and about God's chosen Israelite tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, that they have taught throughout North and South and Central America and Polynesia. Likewise, they define God to be a male like them, thus attributing to God again what is their own failure of leadership to correct the ongoing inhumanity to women. Their coercive claim to being right is doubly compounded by church use of excommunication to threaten church women's rightful use of their power to publicly oppose them when regarding the equality of women. Twice in Mormon verse it is said that if God were unjust, God would cease to be God. It's an album. In these footnotes. If so, who is it then that says to God, "That's it. You're done. You're not God anymore"? We do. Because God's power is the voluntary honor and love of all creation. If sinful, then in one gasp of realization, God's power evaporates. Because such power is the unity arising out of our love and respect. God's power originates inside of each one of us. Women should claim that power. Harriet Lerner points out that women make up over half the world's population. Yet as a group that we wield virtually no economic or political power and have no social authority. We have been taught to pretend that our special role as wives to men and mothers to children somehow accounts for this fact or makes it tolerable or even natural. We should be sensitive to those for whom religious belief provides a sense of security. However, I believe that courage to define oneself is the very essence of Christianity. It's a very scary thing. How can church women assert themselves? Vote. Vote not to sustain presidencies and councils at all levels that do not contain women. Bella Sharia says women need to develop their own strategies for achieving an appropriate place and power in the church. But such changes do not occur merely because of prayer or theology. Women must develop and use their women power. He hypothesizes if for 2 weeks women did not contribute to church funds, unless women's rights were accepted, there would be an immediate impact on the power holders. Or if women contributed instead to funds that supported women's emancipation, Mary's Pence instead of Peter's Pence, there would be more effective power in the women's church. These are nonviolent methods that need to be developed all across the world. Not to be naive, revolution does not produce gentleness, meekness, and love of fame. It is a mistake to expect support or kindness from the church when we oppose it. Openness and authentic public debate of significant issues are not tolerated in the church. They never have been. Hence, you and your family's well-being are not well protected. Witness the example of Janice Allred and others. Mormon leaders equip their members with ready-made labels and prior judgments that are easily used to brand opposing views as apostate or anti-Mormon. However, to be fair, neither is this paper absent labeling when saying that the ongoing sexism is a failure of church leadership. I do not believe that women are any less human or less holy than men. And therefore, I cannot imagine being part of a church that would discriminate against women in any way, or even suggest that a woman is less suited for church office from that of church president or apostle to the humblest role of service. I regard the church's exclusion of women from positions of leadership to be not a sacred tradition, but a manifestation of the sin of patriarchy. The modern woman will note with pleasant surprise that Mary of Nazareth was far from being a timidly submissive woman or one whose piety was repellent to others. On the contrary, she was a woman who did not hesitate to proclaim that God vindicates the humble and the oppressed and removes the powerful people of this world from their privileged positions. The modern woman will recognize in Mary, who stands out above the poor and the humble of the Lord, a woman of strength. Thank you for your attention this morning.
Interesting paper that touches a lot of people that I've addressed over the years at Sunstone. I'll repress my the sort of tendency that I have to respond because I'm not the respondent. And I will invite Paul Tinker, who is the respondent, to come and give his response, but I'm going to reserve for myself the right to maybe ask the first question when we get to the Q&A. Paul has described himself as a repentant attorney, a Sunstone addict, and with a long-time interest in the work of Bishop Fox.
Thank you, Nadine. Life is full of ironies. Life is full of paradoxes. In fact, life may be a paradox. And you see this sitting in front of you, and our general theme for this whole session of of Sunstone this year is about women's issues, and so what do we have? We have two men talking about women's issues and feminism and, where angels fear to tread. I don't presume to be a feminist a theologian or an expert of any kind. I merely have an interest, and so I would certainly defer to people like Janice and Maxine and Margaret and Nadine, who is here with us, to really comment on the substantive issues. I want to just make a few comments and observations of interest along the way for this, what I consider a very provocative and interesting and powerful statement of some of the issues that we deal with frequently. As Nadine mentioned, I have had a long interest in the works of John Shelby Spong. Bishop Spong is a now retired Episcopal priest. He was born in North Carolina, as Nelson was. He spent most of his ministry in the state of New Jersey, and he is very outspoken on many of these issues, including women's issues. The book that Nelson has relied on very heavily in this presentation is this one. It's called Born of a Woman, A Bishop Rethinks the Virgin Birth and the Treatment of Women by a Male-Dominated Church. Now you could almost think that that grew out of the Mormon experience, but it grows out of Episcopalianism. Bishop Spong, I think our sort of prejudice is probably that in Episcopalianism it would be hard to be a heretic, but many people consider Bishop Spong a heretic even within his own tradition. This book is his autobiography. It's called Here I Stand, My Struggle for a Christianity of Integrity, Love, and Equality. It is a very powerful book. To any of you who are interested in the particular issues around women that we have been discussing here today, or many of the other issues about religious fundamentalism and scriptural literalism and so forth, Bishop Spong has written extensively on these topics and women's place and power. And I think one of the perspectives that we can gain from what he has told us with the background from Bishop Spong is that this issue is in no way peculiar to Mormonism. It may seem intensified or exaggerated to some extent in Mormon culture, but my experience is that many things that come from Christian tradition have been magnified or intensified in the way we have applied them in Mormonism. The literalism about Scripture, and he talks about the Genesis story and how we've applied that and the conclusions that we draw from it. And one of Bishop Spong's favorite themes that he's written extensively on is the danger that we get into when we are too literal about Scripture, and for the most part, that's what we do. Now, if you don't want to take the time to read Bishop Spong's long and ponderous works on this topic, a nice short version of the dangers of scriptural literalism is in the current issue of Sunstone magazine, and the author is sitting right here on the front row, Bill Russell, from the Community of Christ. If you would really like to get really hands-on about the problems of scriptural literalism and why we need warning labels on our scriptures, read Bill's article in the current issue of Sunstone. Nelson points out that
these things are not peculiar to modern times either. They've gone on for many years. And he says, such Bible-based oppression of women has continued for 2,000 years. When we start looking backwards that way and saying what has been for 2,000 years or 5,000 years, we get in real trouble because we don't fully appreciate the historical context. And when we try to justify present practices by what went on in biblical times, in the time of Genesis or whatever, we're in real trouble. That's why I get really upset when I hear people like Mitt Romney get up and say, well, marriage has been this way for 5,000 years, and so why should we change it? Well, if he only knew what that 5,000 years of history had really been like, it's not modern, romantic, Western civilization marriage. And it is very damaging and hurtful and hateful to use that historical precedent to justify modern-day oppressive practices. Another point I wanted to make to bring this particularly to the Mormon context, and Nelson really doesn't get into this in his paper, but what I mentioned, life is full of paradoxes, and to me, the great paradox when we discuss this issue in Mormonism is Mormonism has a potential solution for all of this. Mormonism, of all the major present-day creeds in America, has a built-in way out of this whole dilemma. We actually have this whole concept of mother in heaven. But we can't talk about it. We can't say it. We can't pray. What is wrong with this picture? We have the answer, and at the same time, it is taken away from us. This is something that I have never understood. One more particular comment, and then I'm going to turn it back to Nadine, and we'll have some questions. Nelson mentions the example of his relative who had 9 children, and there was some damage, and birth control was not even an option. And he quotes several church leaders on this older view of what sexual relations in marriage are all about. And another paradox that I need to point out is that we've learned just in the last few years that even at the higher levels, some of this is changing a little bit, but it's never changed really publicly or officially or openly. It's changed by little deletions in the Church Handbook of Instructions, so that some of this old language is no longer there, but there's no new proclamation that says, well, we didn't really mean all that, or I'm talking specifically about restrictions on how sex should be viewed in marriage. We have this problem of when we do change, we change rather silently, we change quietly, we don't acknowledge what we're doing. That is a great problem, and that's why I think that Nelson's call to activism and to speaking out is very, very worth considering. Nelson has a few copies of his paper, and if you're really interested in this, you really need the paper because the devil is in the details. Some of the real meat is in the footnotes. You need to follow the footnotes, and they are very, very good. So he has a few copies here. He also has a little slip of paper that will give you the website. If you don't get a hard copy, it's completely available on the web. And then I have this little handout, as I mentioned, of a list of the major works of John Shelby Spong. I have about about 25 copies of that if you're interested. John Shelby Spong, I think, speaks loudly not only to modern-day Christians, but also to modern-day Mormons who confront these very same issues within our tradition, and I think he gives us a lot of insight. So I really commend Nelson for bringing Bishop Spong to our attention and bringing his views to bear on an issue that troubles and concerns many of us.
Thank you, Paul. I've been doing this for 20 years. I've tried speaking out. I've tried raising consciousness in my local ward. And I've gotten to the point where there's nothing left to do but vote with my feet. And I think that is really the only thing Mormon women can do. Because I've also tried writing letters to general authorities, trying to have a dialogue. And I none of those things were ever successful. And so finally, you know, after 20 years, I decided not to beat myself over the head anymore. And I just decided to just ignore what they say and do what I want, which I've kind of been doing all along. And But I think there's one line in this paper that I found very interesting. He was talking about the victory of authoritarianism in the church, which has become very, very complete since the beginning of correlation, where everything is so controlled now. There are no avenues to make another voice heard. And you can come to Fenstone and you can sort of make this a matter of public discussion here, but just as he points out, women who have done this have been disciplined, have been excommunicated. I've been through my own set of discussions with my state president on more than one occasion over things that I said at Sunstone. But he has this one line where he talks about this authoritarianism, and he says that the authoritarianism does not mean that the victory is permanent. The dignity, rights, and power of women make that victory unstable. And I really think that what we see in the church today is the beginnings of that instability. The church has a lot of control over church programs, but I think that in a lot of ways it now has less control over its members. I hear things about how hard it is to get people to accept callings nowadays, for instance. You know, even 20, 30 years ago, a calling was from God and you had to accept that calling. And especially, I hear about this in sort of women's callings. I remember somebody getting up in testimony meeting and fretting about the fact that the bishop had extended calls to the nursery to about 10 different people and gotten a flat no from all of them. So, yes, he said, no, the nursery is the hardest calling in the church. Nobody really wants to do that. And that's traditionally been women's work. And so if women are saying, no, I'm not going to do that work anymore, then the church has to start accommodating the needs of women. And I think that this really quite major change in 2000, I think it was, where it was the Church Handbook of Instruction, it really signaled something pretty significant. Of course, it's like that saying, if the people lead, the leaders will follow. And the birth rate in Mormon society has already fallen substantially. It's still higher than the national average, but 50% higher than 1.9 children is still less than 3 children. And that's even a few years ago, I think, what the desired number of children for young Mormon women was. It was somewhere around 2.5, I think, if I recall right. But it's interesting that when they made this change in the Church Handbook of Instructions and they said that, the number of children that a couple should have is a private matter between the couple and the Lord, and we should not, members of the church should not judge each other over the decisions about family size. And yet they put this in a book that is limited to only the bishop and the state president and a few other people. It's not out there publicly where people can see it. So they, like Paul said, they change it very quietly.
The only way we knew about it is because it got into the press. There was never a letter read over the pulpit or anything.
I could tell you something about how that got into the press, but I won't go into that right now. okay, not on the tape. All right. So I guess I don't really have a question. It was more a comment. But I would like to give Nelson the opportunity to respond, maybe if he wants to, about how women can, about what women can do to stop being complicit in our own oppression.
Well, I think that it's up to women. I really do, and I dare not say how, but it has been attempted. Janice Allred has the Mormon Women's Forum here. I do think that the church is fragile. I think that the effort is enormous that it takes for the church to hold its people together, the work of and the testimonies, the extremes that we go to get people to believe and to commit and to give. I think there's there could be a groundswell, and that's really, I mean, I had to ask the question, do we walk or do you want to stay and claim it? Because the leaders do have to follow the members, and it's that. But I don't know whether the groundswell is there and whether it's ready and whether the women will come forward. Maybe the Eric Fromm's Escape from Freedom is the dominant emotional feeling within men and women in the Mormon Church. We serve a clientele. We serve people who seek this security, this safety. We make these promises, and so we provide a service to a segment of society. But I don't think so. I really think that, and even were that true, I'm against it. I think that we should be trying to be more proactive, that just because I think it's a better way. But here, who's to say, right? I mean, if the church membership wants to live that way, if they really want to live that right way, then perhaps we should leave that alone.
Thank you. Our time really is up, but if anybody has a quick question, yes.
You know, I just noticed in my own experience, talking to women, you know, they normally take the position that if the church is right, you know, we should be serving, you know, like the church places. But in the last 6 months to 9 months since the Da Vinci Code came out, I've talked to some of the women who were so dynamic that way to begin with, and the Da Vinci Code had made them start to think.
That's really interesting. The comment. The comment I want to make sure we have it on the tape is that he's talked to a lot of Mormon women who have traditionally thought that things are the way that they should be, and he didn't really want to change anything. But since in the last 6 to 9 months, since the Da Vinci Code came out, they really started to think. I'm glad that we're going to be discussing the Da Vinci Code in several sessions here. I think it's an extremely interesting phenomenon that's going on. And I think that probably a revolution has to take place at that local grassroots level, because it's the only place it can take place. And it probably has to take place in people's quiet acts. And they're claiming their own power and claiming their own roles in life. Because I think that going up against this powerful institution is not something they can do directly. So I think women will do what women have always done, which is use their positions of influence to have the kind of life that they want to have. Thank you very much.